This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, October 17, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Hundreds of thousands of people gather in Washington, D.C. for the Millions More March. And as the cleanup effort heads underway in New Orleans, residents there are evicted with nowhere to go. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The death toll in the October 8th earthquake in Kashmir has soared to over 50,000. The Prime Minister of Pakistan-administered Kashmir said the toll could rise to 70,000. Cut off by landslides, many affected villages are still inaccessible in both sides of Kashmir. Bad weather is adding to the difficulties of rescuers and survivors alike. From Srinagar, Shanawaz Khan reports.
Rain and snowfall in most parts of divided Kashmir over the weekend added to the miseries of people rendered homeless by the killer quake on October 8. On Sunday, six Pakistani army personnel engaged in relief operations were killed in a helicopter crash, reportedly due to bad weather. Incessant rains hampered the relief and rescue operations and threatened more casualties among the homeless in Kashmir. 9 days after the quake, hundreds of thousands of people are without any shelter. Facing a severe shortage, Pakistan is asking other countries to donate tents. It has even lifted an import ban on tents from India. The government in Indian-administered Kashmir says it has managed to distribute around 7,000 tents, although it needs more than 40,000. The government in Indian Kashmir today started distributing cash relief among the quake victims to help people find housing before the harsh winter. As winter snowfalls approach and the temperatures drop, time is already running out for those left homeless by the earthquake. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shanawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
Tropical storm Wilma is predicted to develop into a hurricane in the coming days. The storm is expected to make landfall along the Gulf of Mexico by Friday. Wilma is the 21st major storm to develop this hurricane season. This year has tied with 1933 as the busiest storm season on record. The Mexican countryside has been hard hit by natural disasters this year. Floods caused by Hurricane Stan severely damaged crops in the south, while a drought has taken its toll on the harvest in the north. In Oaxaca, Vladimir Flores reports.
According to official data, Hurricane Stan's intense rains killed 36 people in Mexico and caused heavy economic losses for 90,000 people in the states of Chiapas, Oaxaca, Puebla, and Veracruz. Federal deputies are asking that the federal government declare the region a disaster zone. Meanwhile, the worst drought in 80 years has affected more than 2.5 million acres of corn, beans, and oats in the northern states of Zacatecas and Durango. 40% of Mexico's beans are produced in Zacatecas. This year's drought has reduced the bean output of Zacatecas by half. The government of Durango estimates that local farmers have lost 90% of total bean production. Corn and beans are the primary foods consumed by Mexicans. Free Speech Radio News, Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores.
Human rights representatives and government officials have opened an investigation into what caused this weekend's fire in a Buenos Aires prison. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
At least 32 prisoners died from asphyxiation during a fire in the Magdalena State Penitentiary in the Buenos Aires province over the weekend. According to the provincial government's official version, the fire broke out during a fight between prison inmates that escalated into a jail riot late Saturday night. Prisoners from the neighboring ward rescued the survivors and dragged out all of the bodies they could find. Just days before the deaths, lawyers from the National Commission Against Torture visited 10 inmates staging a hunger strike to demand humane conditions inside the Magdalena State Penitentiary ward. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Violence has escalated in the West Bank on the eve of a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and President George Bush. Manar Jabrin reports.
Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mufaz decided to resume military incursions and to impose restrictions on the movement of Palestinians in the West Bank after three Israeli settlers were killed during a drive-by shooting on Sunday. The shooting occurred near the West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Nablus. Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade's the armed wing of Fatah ruling party claimed responsibility for the attacks. On Monday morning, Israeli army troops arrested 18 Palestinians wanted in connection with the shooting. Israel decided to suspend all communications with the Palestinian Authority, including a planned meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that was scheduled for early November. President Abbas is expected to meet with the United States President George Bush on Thursday. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraqis took to the polls this weekend amid relative calm as residents voted on the country's draft constitution. Vote counting continues, and early results indicate Shiite-dominated areas backing the charter, while Sunni provinces appear to have largely cast votes against it. While the Bush administration has hailed this weekend's turnout, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says it remains unclear what effect voting will have on Iraq.
We had hoped that the constitutional process would have been an exercise that would have been totally inclusive and pulled together all the Iraqis, helping with reconciliation. Obviously, that did not happen and has not happened. And so it is very difficult to say what happens after the votes are counted.
Iraqi voters indicated a simple yes or no vote this weekend to approve or reject the country's draft constitution, which was recently drawn up by the Iraqi parliament. The charter will be ratified if a simple majority of voters vote yes, but only if two-thirds of voters in three of Iraq's provinces do not say no. Results from this weekend's referendum are expected by the end of the work week. FSRN Salam Talib spoke with Moeed Al-Hamdani, an Iraqi journalist living in Baghdad, about this weekend's referendum.
What are people hoping the new constitution will accomplish?
Americans are always saying that a civil war will erupt if the constitution fails. But now the people, especially in Mosul, are afraid that the Americans will cause the constitution to fail. In many cities, Americans have taken the voting boxes to U.S. bases. For example, in Diyala, they took Khalakin, Jeola, and Al-Sadia's votes to be counted in the U.S. military base, called Cobra.
What your expectation as Iraqi about who will vote yes for the constitution?
The constitution was accepted by people in the south and was refused by the Sunni Arabs. Now we see the reverse. The south does not accept the constitution for two main reasons. First, they do not trust the government anymore after they decided to change the constitution in the last 48 hours. So now the writers of the constitution put in the document that it will not be the same for the next 8 years. Instead, the parliament can change it any time they want. Americans pushed the government to change the constitution at the last minute. So why should the people trust the constitution? The government changed the constitution and almost wiped out the reason for having a constitution in the first place. They redefined the definition of an Iraqi voter, so now even foreigners can be defined as Iraqis.
FSRN Salam Talib spoke with Moeed Al-Hamdani, an Iraqi journalist living in Baghdad. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. The 15th Ibero-American Summit, held in Spain over the weekend, called for an end to the U.S. blockade against Cuba and for the extradition to Venezuela of Luis Posada Carriles, who is wanted for the bombing of a Cuban airliner. Joseph Muti has more from Havana.
The meeting in Salamanca ended with a resolution that included the statement, "We ask the government of the United States of America to put an end to the economic, commercial, and financial blockade that it maintains against Cuba." This was the first time that the 22-nation summit used the term blockade to refer to Washington's efforts to economically isolate Cuba. Havana insists that blockade rather than embargo is the right connotation because the U.S. continuously attempts to prevent other nations from trading with the island. The leaders of Spain, Portugal, and most of the nations of Latin America now agree, as does Walter Lippmann, who edits a Los Angeles-based electronic international news service on Cuba.
The outcome at Salamanca was extremely significant for two reasons. First of all, because the delegates used the term blockade rather than the sanitized term embargo, the term blockade is in fact more accurate a reflection of what is actually happening as the United States attempts to impose its own unilateral policies on the rest of the world.
A special communique by the summit also approved a Cuban-backed resolution on terrorism in which the summit nations supported steps to, quote, achieve the extradition or bring to justice the person responsible for the terrorist attack on a Cubana de Aviación plane in October 1976, which killed 73 civilians, unquote. The communique was referring to Luis Posada Carriles, a former CIA agent who is currently in U.S. custody for immigration violations. A U.S. judge has refused to extradite him. Venezuela seeks his extradition because he holds Venezuelan citizenship and the bombed plane originated in Caracas. Along with his co-conspirator, Orlando Bosch, Posada Carriles is characterized by the FBI as a terrorist, but received the protection of George Bush Sr. Cubans now see Bush Jr. continuing his father's protection of perhaps the most reviled man in the nation's history. Walter Lippmann.
In addition to using terminology which more accurately reflects the situation, the summit's decision to call for the extradition of the terrorists responsible for the bombing of the Cubana airliner in 1976 was also very important because this was the first time that this prestigious international body had publicly taken this position, or indeed any position, in relation to this terrorist act.
Summit participants also expressed their profound concern for the pardon of Posada Carriles by a former Panamanian president with ties to the Miami Cuban exile community after he and three others had been found guilty of explosives charges related to an attempt on the life of Cuban President Fidel Castro during a previous Ibero-American summit. José de León is one of the some 100 low-income U.S. students studying medicine for free in Cuba. He said that given the history of Miami-based aggression against Cuba, the statement relating to Posada Carriles was very important.
I think it's important, the request to extradite Posada Carriles, because this has been something that has hugely ignored for several decades, and it's being brought into international light, and it's being supported internationally as well, because this is also bringing attention to the hypocrisy of the United States war against terrorism, because this is a man who basically has self-proclaimed himself as a terrorist.
After the resolution was passed, Cuba's foreign minister, Felipe Perez Roque, commented that on top of the important decision to include the word blockade in the resolution and the subsequent communique on Posada Carriles, he was surprised that not a single head of state or foreign minister defended the Washington unrestricted free market and privatization policies seen by his government as so destructive for Latin America and the Caribbean. In Havana for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Mutti.
Congress is expected to take up its budget reconciliation bill this week that is poised to cut taxes by $70 billion while cutting tens of thousands of dollars more in programs for the poor. Mitch Jezerich reports from Washington, D.C.
Advocates for children in foster care are sounding the alarm bell over a potential $10 billion or more cut to the nation's health care program for the poor, known as Medicaid. It is Medicaid that pays for a vast majority of health care services for the some 800,000 kids who are in foster care. 22-year-old Danielle Oren is a former foster care child and current advocate with the Child Welfare League of America.
Those children that are aging out of foster care are, in most states, left without any medical coverage and age out of the foster care system with no support systems in place, no net, no safety net to catch them if they need medical care or mental health services.
A recent study by Harvard Medical School and the Casey Family Program suggests that over 50% of young adults like Danielle Oren, who had formerly been in foster care, will develop at least one major mental health problem. Dr. David Rubin of Philadelphia's Children's Hospital is the co-author of a new study suggesting that cuts to Medicaid would decrease access to mental health services for foster care children.
When you look at kids in foster care, you're talking about a population of kids, even among all kids in Medicaid, that are using 8 to 10 times the level of services as other kids in Medicaid. As a pediatrician, I give you the story of that child who suffered years of abuse and neglect, who comes into the system needing weekly counseling sessions for depression or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder. Yet those weekly counseling sessions might get cut off if the EPSDT benefit is rolled back.
In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, there was speculation that Congress wouldn't enact major cuts to programs for the poor like Medicaid and food stamps. But it appears that sentiment has all but vanished on Capitol Hill. James Horney is an economist with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
So for a while, there was a thought that maybe the congressional leadership would not push ahead with the spending cuts in reconciliation. But then you started getting a lot of agitation from conservative pundits, conservative groups around Washington, and some of the most conservative members of the House and to some extent the Senate, who were saying, oh, the deficits are going to be higher as a result of all this spending that we're going to do for Katrina and Rita, and we need to offset that. And you started getting proposals for these offsets, and about 40% of the cuts they proposed would actually come in low-income programs.
Those in Congress looking to slash even more from what's known as discretionary spending were emboldened in their quest last week by President Bush.
I call on members to make real cuts in non-security spending.
While the House and Senate have agreed already to $35 billion in cuts to mostly programs for the poor, the House is expected to propose cutting an additional $15 billion later in the week. This while Congress is also on the verge in the same spending bill to enact tax cuts worth $70 billion. Again, James Horney.
This has been a lopsided process. The $35 billion that was assumed in the budget resolution cut entitlement programs, significant portion of that would come out of programs for low-income people. If they do more than $35 billion, it's very likely that the incremental amount up to $50 billion would come primarily out of programs for low-income people. On the other hand, the proposed tax cuts, the $70 billion in tax cuts to be achieved through reconciliation, would come overwhelmingly from cuts in taxes that would benefit the wealthiest Americans.
This week, the Senate takes up its budget reconciliation bill, and next week, the House will do the same. The cuts to Medicaid and other programs like food stamps are not a done deal. There are still some who think with hundreds of thousands of people still displaced due to the hurricane and heating bills likely to rise again, that now is not the time for such reductions. But their fight will be an uphill battle. Mitch Cheserich, Free Speech Radio News in Washington.
As Hurricane Katrina floodwaters have receded and the beginnings of cleanup are underway in New Orleans, differing visions of how to rebuild are already coming into conflict as public housing residents face immediate eviction with no alternative housing offered. Jenka Soderberg reports from New Orleans.
Residents of Forest Park Apartments in New Orleans have staged a rally and takeover of the apartment management office to challenge the management's forced removal of the residents over the weekend. Ms. Charlestine Jones is a resident of Forest Park.
We found our place to be livable, and we all were trying to get an understanding from the landlord as to why couldn't we just stay in one area until they repair one side and move over to the next side. She said we couldn't do this. We needed to all evacuate, even without having a place to go. If we didn't have ourselves out by Sunday, that they were going to just put us out on the curb.
In the face of Hurricane Katrina, Governor Kathleen Blanco declared that there would be a stay on all housing evictions until the 25th of October. Residents claim that even if they are given until the 25th, there is no alternative housing available in the New Orleans area. Jay Manning is a community organizer with the C3, Caring Community Compassion Coalition, in New Orleans.
The Housing Authority of New Orleans residents, over 32,000, have not been able to come back to their apartments. They're all African American. They could move back immediately. Why is it not happening? We say because there's wealthy developers, the Cannizzaros, the Kabakoffs, and the hotel industry that have been gunning for that property for years, and they are using this strategy to put through their final solution, to grab it, turn it into high-priced condos, yes, and to drive out the African-American working-class community there.
The problems faced by public housing tenants in New Orleans did not begin with Hurricane Katrina. Over the past year, residents of the Iberville Housing Project near the French Quarter have been fighting to keep their public housing open. Mike Howell, with the Hands Off Iberville Coalition, questions the commission Mayor Nagin has put together to plan the rebuilding of New Orleans, saying that there is an overrepresentation of housing developers on the commission. Mike Howell.
First of all, there are three guys who are identified as developers, but there's a fourth one, the co-chair, Barbara Majors, who works hand in glove with Joe Cannizzaro, who's one of the leading developers here. Cannizzaro and Majors worked with the gentrifiers to destroy the St. Thomas housing complex, which many of those people who were kicked out of St. Thomas a couple years ago ended up in the lower Ninth Ward and other areas that were flooded. God knows how many of those people died. And we don't want any more tragedies like that. Certainly all the public housing in the city center, where most of it used to be, is a safe area. And we want the public housing reopened.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jenka Soderberg in New Orleans.
During his keynote address at the Millions More March this Saturday, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan called on the black elite to devote their privilege and talents to building a movement of change in African American communities throughout the United States. Hundreds of thousands gathered to hear Farrakhan and others speak on issues concerning health care, economic disparities, and the response to Hurricane Katrina. Selena Masuta brings us voices from the rally.
10 years ago at the Million Man March, Jim Embrum pledged with crowds of black men and boys to take personal responsibility of their families and communities. This year, Embrum traveled with a friend from Detroit, Michigan, with the hope that the Millions More movement would provide solutions to the hardships facing African-American communities.
We came here 10 years ago, a lot of great speakers, a lot of emotion, a lot of discussion of the plight of African-Americans. But we left here without, in my view, enough structure, enough plans, enough solutions for what should be the work over the next 10 years.
The 1995 march targeted only black men, but this march was open to all men and women of different racial backgrounds. Safiza Nettleton brought her son from New York.
I came to the march, you know, because I just felt the need to, you know, be around a lot of people that were like me and that was looking for a more progressive community and a more progressive people and a people that loved each other, because I really think that we are in trouble as a black nation.
Not all who wanted to be at the march felt welcomed. FSRN reported last week that Minister Louis Farrakhan met with the National Black Justice Coalition, or NBJC, a black lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender civil rights group, and said he would allow Keith Boykin, president of the NBJC, to speak as an openly gay man at the rally. The night before the march, chief organizer of the Millions More Movement March, Reverend Willie Wilson, took Boykin off the speaker's list. Tara Lake expressed her anger and disappointment.
It's not enough for us to toil and then to be disrespected and then to be maligned and then to be threatened when it becomes convenient for leadership. And so we're here in support, and we're also here to demand a place.
More than 100 black lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgenders marched through the Millions More movement, chanting and holding signs, calling for recognition of their lives.
From the District of Columbia, this is Selena Masuta.
More than in any other state, federal recognition of Indian tribes is synonymous with Indian gaming in Connecticut, since two of the most successful casinos in the world are run by the state's two federally recognized tribes there. Two more tribal nations in the state, the Scaticooks and the Eastern Pequots, were granted federal recognition in the past few years. But state officials, fearing yet more casinos, pulled out all the stops to get the recognition reversed. They succeeded on Columbus Day, October 12. But the leaders of these two tribal nations say they've played by the U.S. government's rules and proven they qualify for federal recognition. They also insist the issue of sovereignty should be separate from the hot-button issue of casinos. At least one of the tribes says it plans to appeal what it calls a politically motivated ruling and demand a congressional investigation of the process. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs requires that a tribe seeking federal recognition meet 7 requirements. One is that it must descend from a tribe of Native Americans that existed at the time when non-Indians made first sustained contact with the tribe.
It's amazingly difficult to put together a petition like the one that's required by the federal government. They want tribes like Scaticook to show for 350 years, on a substantially continuous basis, as they say in the regulations, that tribe has continued to exist throughout time. 350 years.
That was Steve Austin, a cultural anthropologist who worked for the BIA for 7 years in the 1990s and then went to work as a private contractor for tribes all over the hemisphere. He worked on the petitions for both the Eastern Pequots and the Scaticokes and says despite the difficulties, both tribes earned federal recognition in 2002 and 2004, respectively. But in its reversal last week, the BIA ruled that the tribes had failed to maintain a separate Indian community and exercise political authority over their members on a substantially continuous basis. All the state's top officials attacked the tribes for allying with wealthy backers who planned to establish casinos on the reservations if the tribes were federally acknowledged. Scaticoke Chief Richard Velke says his tribal nation has been pursuing federal recognition for more than 20 years.
From 1981 to 1997, we did it on our own. Climate changed, and by the climate I mean once gaming got involved in 1988, then the resistance started to attack the tribes seeking federal recognition. We have no other choice but to go out and find a financial backer or lose your identity. We weren't about to lose our identity.
With federal recognition comes the designation of a tribe as a, quote, semi-sovereign, dependent nation. This includes the possibility of establishing casinos as well as other types of economic development, including management of their natural resources. Recognition also grants a level of political autonomy, including electing leaders and running tribal courts, and it provides for educational scholarships for Native Americans, health services, and low-interest loans for housing and small businesses. The Scaticokes and Eastern Pequots charged that the bar was raised impossibly high on their applications in an effort to keep more casinos out of the state. And according to that standard, no tribe could get federal recognition. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal disagrees.
The standard was exactly the same, that even if a more lenient standard had been applied, 150-year gaps in evidence on key criteria simply come nowhere near to meeting the standard.
The Eastern Pequots are still deciding whether to file a federal appeal, but Steve Austin says the Scaticokes are planning to appeal on the grounds that the ruling is arbitrary and capricious.
They've heightened the requirements beyond what they've ever required them to be before, and I think we should be able to establish that in federal court, which could lead to this being overturned. It's an uphill battle. Only one tribe has ever done this before and successfully. That was the Samish tribe in Washington State.
The state charged that casino interests wielded undue influence over the process and requested an investigation by the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, chaired by Senator John McCain. Blumenthal says a memorandum was uncovered indicating an irregularity in granting recognition, but no one was charged with wrongdoing. Now Chief Velke says McCain should conduct another investigation because the tribes are charging the state with undue influence.
He needs to have another hearing, but this time he needs the people on the hot seat from the state of Connecticut, not the tribe sitting in front of them.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations, WPFW in Washington, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFA in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. Free Speech Radio News is an independent, worker-run collective. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.